Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free on Patreon. This week I'm talking to Scarlett Heinberg about her book, We Met on the Other Side. Scarlett is an internationally known speaker in the area of near-death experiences, spiritual awareness, and energy healing. Her story was featured on the History Channel's show, The Unexplained, hosted by William Shatner. Scarlett holds a PhD in public policy and administration and a master's degree in public health. Scarlett is certified in two forms of Reiki, hypnotherapy, and neuro-linguistic programming. Hi, Scarlett. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Simon. I'm really excited to be here today.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called We Met on the Other Side. But first of all, I wanted to talk to you about your near-death experience you had when you were four. What happened there?
Okay, thank you. Yes, when I was four, this was in the early 1960s, 1964 to be exact. I was in a swimming pool in our neighborhood, and there it was a very hot summer day, and I was in the shallow end with my sister, who's a year older than I am, and then my brother was in the kiddie pool. My mother, who's a nurse, was there as well, keeping an eye on us as well as she could, with us being in two separate pools with my brother and my sister and I. And there was a lifeguard there. It was just super crowded. Well, I was kind of bobbing up and down on the floor of the pool, you know, in the very shallow end, but I didn't realize that I kept going backwards with every bob up. And so what happened, Simon, is that I ended up not touching the bottom of the pool on the last back bob down, and I started to swallow water. Well, as I began to panic and try to tread water, I just couldn't get any kind of traction. And so I kept swallowing water, and then everything went dark. The next thing I do recall is a sense of myself being hovering on the edge of the pool up and above, and seeing my physical body on the bottom of the pool. Back then we wore these little pink kind of plastic caps, and I could see the pink cap and through the hazy, wavy water. But I was completely aware that that was also me hovering on the edge of the pool. And I was just embraced in this peace, this love, total contentment, absolute just peace. And I loved being there, and I didn't want to leave that. And I just felt so safe. And I knew that my body was there. And again, there's just no question in my mind about that I was both of these things, that consciousness there and that body on the bottom of the pool. I also was aware of things. I could feel my mother's feelings. I could feel her panic when she saw me. She noticed I was missing, and she dived into the pool and got me out. And being a nurse, she knew how to revive me. Years later, when we talked about this, I asked her point blank. I said, "Mom, you know, what had happened?" She said, "Well, for a while you were blue and you were not breathing and you were not with us." So I understood that I'd had a near-death experience, but at the time, there was no term like that, so there was no way to understand or talk about what had happened, except that, hey, I drowned. I knew that I had this experience outside of my body, and I just had no doubt at all in my mind that there was something more than this physical form. And I also, as I mentioned, I could feel my mother's feelings. And I also felt like I had a choice, that I honestly didn't want to have to come back, because I knew it was going to be a hard life. And it's hard to explain how I just knew so much in that small time, but it's a timelessness there. And they're on that side and being out of your body. And there's just so much knowledge. And even now, all these years later, it is so hard to try to describe these experiences, because we don't have words in our language to really capture how different time is out of your body, how everything is just like a download of knowledge, but yet you may not have the words to be able to explain it to others. But I did know I had a choice, and it was love from my mother that encouraged me to make the decision to return to this life, even knowing it would not be an easy one. So that's what happened back then. And I just, you know, it took years before I could even realize that that was indeed a near-death experience, only because I was so young. And when you're that young, there's no before and after. I wasn't fundamentally changed. I was just having an experience that I did not question because of how profound it was. And what I didn't realize was that being out of my body and that close to death and being in this state of consciousness, that it kept a doorway open. I call it a portal to that other side. And so as I grew up, being a very, very sensitive and aware child, I had feelings about things. I seemed to know things about people that there was no logical explanation for how I could possibly know things about people. Like I would know sometimes like things like when my grandfather was going to pass away, I woke up that morning knowing the exact time he would die. And I told my mother that. I said, "Mama, you know, Grandpa's going to pass tonight at 11:17. And she said, "Honey, how can you know that? He had been sick, so we knew that death might be coming at some time. But I just knew it was going to be that day and that time, because the number flashed into my mind." And I call it knowing. So I mean, for lack of a better word, it's just I knew it to be true. I saw it. And he did. He passed later that night. The clock, when he passed and we were all with him gathered around, said 11:15. I thought, oh, well, I guess my timing was off. And then later I found out the clock was 2 minutes slow. So actually was 11:17. But when Grandpa passed his, he had his car there and the horn went off very loudly and it just blared for quite some time until my father went out to try to unplug it or do whatever he needed to do to stop it. And we had some posters in the closet and they fell down. We heard them whooshing down into the floor of the closet and all this when Grandpa passed away. So it was just an interesting experience to be with him and an honor to be with him as he transitioned out of his body. And I knew I wasn't sad because I knew he was going to be in such a wonderful place. And my grandmother had passed away just months before and he had missed her terribly. So I just felt this sense of joy and peace as he passed on, knowing that he would be with my grandmother again and that he was happy, and knowing the beauty and joy of that just made me feel really happy for him. Of course, I would miss him, but having that sense of the other side there just changes how you look at death. And it even did for me as a teenager at that point. But you'd mentioned what had happened. Did you want to say something, Simon?
Well, I wanted to ask you about something with the near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
Did your mother realize that something was wrong in the pool, that it was a kind of intuitive thing? It was like a psychic knowing of suddenly, oh, hang on, there's something wrong. Or is it because she looked around and she saw something?
Well, I think it was both. My mother is very intuitive. She's still with us. She said what had happened was she was keeping an eye on both all of us, and she looked over at the kiddie pool for my brother. And when she looked back, she did not see my head. And then she had an immediate sense of dread and knew that something was wrong. And that's when she got up and came and saw me on the bottom of the pool. So it was both things. I mean, she was doing her best to keep an eye on things, but when she didn't see me, so that's the physical part. She just didn't see me, but her immediate thought was, oh my gosh, something's wrong. And to clarify, back in the 60s, it was required that you wear these bathing caps for girls. So I wasn't the only pink-headed girl in the pool. Let me point that out. So she may not have noticed immediately. She may have seen other pink heads, but she knew I was missing. And so her intuition and her just observations, I think, were what led her to it. And I also, we both understand if she had not gotten me out when she did, I might not have recovered or there might have been other injury for me. But she did get me out in time that I was revivable fairly easily. And Yeah. So I think, again, just her sense of alertness and keeping an eye on the situation, and then her intuitive tug to get up immediately and go look at the pool at the bottom, were, it's kind of a both and.
So with these after effects and this portal being opened, I think you say in the book that it opened to all sorts of energies in other realms. So is that not just like love and light, but also neutral stuff and maybe negative stuff as well?
That's a wonderful question. And yes, that's true. I was not prepared for all the energies in these different dimensions. And so as a young child, I saw spirits, I saw faces of beings that frightened me. In addition to knowing things that there was no way I could know, I also, you know, just had these experiences of things that were very frightening. And again, we're talking the mid-1960s. So there just wasn't a lot of understanding about these things. And particularly for young children, there weren't that many people you could talk to about these sorts of things. So yes, but I remember being very frightened, seeing things that I just couldn't understand. And when family members passed on, it wasn't unusual that their spirits would come visit. And you know, it's still unnerving. Even when you're sensitive and aware, that doesn't, you know, stop you feeling scared. I think that, you know, the body has a physical reaction to otherworldly visits. I know for me, I would get goosebumps and then shiver. And I think it's because there's just electromagnetic energy that maybe we don't fully understand, but that happens with these folks. It's, I've had lights blinking when people pass away, just, but as a young person, I just, I had frightening experiences. I had positive experiences. But that's the whole thing. There was no filter. There was no gate to stop any of this. So it was very hard to just having sensory input without any way to stop it, shut it off, or really protect myself from feeling scared or vulnerable from these kinds of inputs. What I did do was I went to church all the time as a child. I felt safer in what I called God's house. I did have a very strong sense of spirituality. I felt that part of my purpose was to help people to be healing oriented. That didn't mean that I would be a nurse or a medical doctor, but I did care very much about people's well-being. And so I was a comforter. I was a very compassionate child. And I just felt that that was part of the gift from being in that other space, because when you have any kind of contact with that kind of amazing love force, for which there are no real words to be able to describe the magnitude of it, when you realize that we are filled and we are beings of love, but in that realm, but how we choose to behave in this realm often does not reflect that. And as I've mentioned many times, I often was, as a child, just confused by people, because in that realm, it's truth, it's knowledge, it's love. And in this world, it's not like that. People are often dishonest or just not functioning at higher evolved levels. And so, and I could sense that. And I've mentioned before, and I talk about it in my book, and I think it's important to put out the truth, which is, you know, in my childhood, it was tough. My father had a drinking problem with, now we call it alcoholism, but at the time we didn't really know. And he was young, he was depressed. And so it was not an easy childhood at all. And so having this capability of understanding that there is so much love, and yet being in such an environment that was so uncomfortable and frightening and overwhelming for me, it was not a fun childhood, to say the least. And then having these unbidden types of experiences just made for just a tough time. But I did find my peace, as I said, in churches. It did not even matter what religion it was. I just wanted to be in a church setting. I would go with my grandparents often to their church, and I would sing hymns with them, and I loved it. It just felt good to me to be in a safer place. You know, I didn't always understand religion either. I didn't always agree with what I would hear in sermons. It didn't make sense to me how punitive God was presented, because that was not my understanding at all. So having had that sense of love and just absolute bliss and acceptance, you know, once you have that kind of experience, it just seems so crude and difficult to understand that the people just approach God in such a human way, which is not really what I understand. And other people who've had near-death experiences and experienced that type of love relate to more closely.
Was there a time where you went down stairs to a kitchen and your granddad was there and he said you needed to get back to bed and he clapped his hands?
Yes, my cousin told that story. Having had the near-death experience at that young age, Simon, enabled me to have out-of-body experiences. Again, I can say this now, but I didn't have words for these experiences. Because of the turbulence at my home, we spent much time at my grandparents'. And I remember being floating out around their house, floating outside. And so now, as I said, I would know that that's an out-of-body experience, but to me, it was just part of what I did. But apparently, my cousin talked about how my grandfather and my other cousin were having lunch at the house, and a late lunch, and they had put me down for a nap, so I must have been fairly young at that point. And then they're having lunch, and then they see me standing in the kitchen, and my grandfather looks up and says, "You're supposed to be in bed taking your nap," and he claps his hands, and then I disappeared in front of them, both him and my cousin, and they were so shocked, they jumped up. There was no way they saw. I didn't turn and run. I've just disappeared. So they ran up to the room where I was, and I was asleep in bed. And so that, to this day, that story circulated around for years. And then when my cousin told it at a family event, I guess about 10, 15 years ago, I was shocked to hear it again because I just had forgotten. But yeah, she talked about that. So I was able to be out of my body for all those times. And again, you know, we talk about our body and visual sensing, but, you know, I was able to see things that were not in my visual realm in other locations too. So I think that's all related to that near-death experience and being out of my body at 4 years old. Again, having all these capabilities with no names for these things and just accepting them as they were because they were my reality, you know, it was just, again, trying to understand why I was different because I didn't realize that I was. Because this happened at such a young age, I thought everybody was like me or sensitive. And so I learned to be quiet. I felt kind of weird. And so I tried not, I was very shy. And so I ended up not even really talking about what I was experiencing or perceiving. I could talk to my mom. Some, she was pretty sensitive. And my grandmother, who was Pennsylvania Dutch and used to having unusual experiences, she was more accepting. So I felt some safety there. But yes, so that experience did happen.
And so with this thing of, first of all, you felt everybody else could do it. Was it that you talked to other children about it and they'd respond in a weird way?
Well, I would know things. So I would say that something would happen or for example, I had my best friend lived just across the field from my house and her parents and she were going to move away and her mother and she came over one day and I said something to her about, well, I guess, you know, when you move away, your parents and they're divorced. And she was like, what divorce? And, you know, we were probably about 9 or 10 at that point. And so I said, well, you know, when your parents get a divorce, because I could see it. And she just shook her head at me like, what are you talking about? And of course, that's what happened. So, you know, but she was upset with me and I didn't like that. And then other experiences where adults would come and sit with me and ask me questions about their lives and what did I sense? So it was kind of both and. People thought it was a little different, but, you know, if I could help them, you know, understand some events that might be coming their way, then they also wanted that too, a little bit of knowledge or assistance on preparing, I guess, for what might be coming. But again, you know, people's reactions when I knew things were part of what made me feel a little uneasy or a lot uneasy, because that's when I saw not everybody was like me and I was different somehow. And sometimes people behaved in ways that indicated they were frightened or really uncomfortable. And I felt bad. So I had to learn as I got older to not say things. And so that's what I did. So I became very, very quiet at that point.
Well, could you tell us about when you were 16 years old and your Aunt Marion phoned you?
Yes. This was 1976, and she had passed away from a very aggressive form of breast cancer at a young age, and my mother was just grieving terribly. It was my mom's only sister. She was significantly older than my mother, so it was more like a parent to my mom, and mom was just having a horrible time with her death and very depressed and upset, and my aunt had visited me in a dream a few times after she'd passed away. And the first time was really terrifying, but because she looked scary to me. But she kept saying the same thing. She'd say, please tell your mother to stop grieving. She's holding me back. And I didn't know what that meant exactly. Because I knew that in the spiritual realm, she would, you know, be in love. So that was a confusing message. So I would tell mom this. But one day I was home, and this was back in the day when they had the rotary dial phones, not, you know, the cell or even the, you know, hands-free models. But so I heard the phone ring, and we lived in the country, so there was a party line, meaning other people could be on the phone. So when I answered it, and it was the middle of the day, the line was staticky and crackling. And so I said hello a few times, thinking perhaps somebody else was on it. And then I heard my aunt say my name. And she said, Scarlett. And I recognized her voice. And I said, Aunt, her true name is Marguerite. Out of family reasons, I changed it. But I said, Aunt Marguerite. And she said, yes. And I said, but you're dead. And at that point, my whole body was just shivering with chills. It was crackly. It was electric. It was scary. And so she said, I know, honey. She said, but please tell your mom to stop grieving for me. She's holding me back. I'm okay. And, you know, I mean, I knew she was okay. And then, but I was so unnerved by that, because I'm actually holding a phone in the middle of the day. I'm not asleep. I'm hearing her voice, and I just slammed down the phone and ran out of the house. I know it was kind of a silly reaction when I look back, but I was really scared. And then, and she didn't mean to scare me. It's just that I'm hearing her voice and having a conversation with my deceased aunt. And like, how can that happen? I had never heard of phone calls from dead people before. Now we hear more and more about that. But again, these experiences were happening in times when there just weren't conversations around them. So I didn't even know that was a possible thing to have happen. So that's what happened.
If somebody else had been on the line, or if you'd handed the phone to somebody else, do you think they would have heard her? Or maybe it was just you, because you have this talent.
No, I think they would have heard her. Her voice crackled across the line. It was an actual voice. It wasn't something that I heard psychically, for example, or saw psychically rather than with eyes and ears. I actually heard her with my physical ears. And I think if someone had been there, they would have heard her too. What's interesting is that my grandmother, her mother, had a similar experience, not with the phone, but with seeing my aunt come and visit her and tell my grandmother the same message, please tell, you know, my mother to stop grieving. She's holding me back. And so grandma, my grandmother had that identical messaging. So when we later talked to her about what had happened, you know, and she shared what had happened for her, I knew that that kind of verified for me that this was valid. The means and that my aunt used to communicate were varied. Like I said, my grandmother said she saw her with her physical eyes, saw her spirit in her room. And when I'd seen my aunt before, I was in a dream state, but having the phone, the physical phone, actually be her communication method, again, was just really shocking. But I also want to say, too, it took me years to understand her message because I was like, well, how could grief hold her back from moving on in the spiritual realm? And I finally understood it to be that she loved my mother so much that it was her love for my mother's distress that was holding her back, because she wanted to comfort my mother and she wanted her to know, you know, that she was okay. You know, and so we did share this with mom, and mom being a very intuitive person would say, you know, well, why didn't she see me? Why didn't she visit me? Why didn't I have this sort of experience? And, you know, both my grandmother and I didn't know quite how to answer her question with that. But years later, I've given it some serious thought and concluded that it was because mom's grief was so great. She just could not get out of that cloud and allow any energy in at that point. So that's the best way I can kind of give some sort of perspective on what happened, except that, again, being that 16-year-old, being very frightened by having that kind of physical contact.
It's a thing of maybe the grief is a block, isn't it? Or maybe... Yes. If your mother had had contact from her sister, she wouldn't have trusted it. She wouldn't have believed it. She might have thought, oh, it's just my brain making stuff up.
Right. That's a really good point.
So can we talk about when you were, is it in Hungary, and you met a guy who'd had a near-death experience?
Yes. We were in Hungary for an International Association of Near-Death Studies event from held by... Well, it was a celebration, cultural celebration, and Tibor Putnaki was there. He's pretty well known, and he's passed on now, but he had invited us to come and share our story, so we did. And some folks from IANS were there interviewing other people who lived in Hungary about their shared death, near-death, or their near-death experiences. And we were invited to sit in on one of the interviews. And so we did, and the man who was speaking, sharing his experience, did not speak much English. So his wife was there interpreting, and his daughter, and then the couple who was interviewing him and the questionnaire they were going through. And then my husband and I were there as well. And he was talking about his horrible car accident where he crashed into a tree and the steering wheel had actually broken and gone through his skull, and that he died in that time and had a near-death experience. And then he looked at me and said, and everyone heard this, and he points at me and he said, and you were there. And I'm looking at him like, I don't know this man, I've never met him before. And yet he said, you were there. And, you know, and I was like, oh my gosh. And so he did survive. He still has scars, and he had some brain injury from the magnitude of this accident. But what was really also interesting was that he and my husband had the identical model car. This was back in the, I believe, late 80s or early 90s when he had his accident. And so it was that model. And my husband, he had the same car, the same year model. And so when this man's sharing his accident and saying he saw me there in his near-death experience, I didn't know what to make of that. Because again, we don't have words sometimes to capture all these experiences. Later, I've because of what we'll be getting to in a minute, having had what I call a shared near-death experience in which one person is dying and I have a capability of being out of my body to be with them on part of the journey. What I heard him say was we were having a shared near-death experience because he was having the near-death experience and saw me there in which I was sharing it with him on some level. He seemed to perceive my presence there as a healing and comforting event, which I was gratified to hear. But I've thought about that for years, wondering, well, how did that happen? What does that mean? And what do I take from that? So that was just a very unusual thing to have happen. And, you know, I still ponder that.
Have you ever wondered what happens after we die? In my new book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, I share 30 incredible stories of people who were clinically dead, some with no heartbeat, no brain activity, yet returned with knowledge that was later verified. These accounts challenge everything we think we know about consciousness and the afterlife. It's available now as an ebook, paperback, and audiobook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other good bookshops. Again, it's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, and I hope you check it out. And you have no memory of meeting up with him like that?
Well, when he said it, I had a moment where my spirit kind of, I don't know a word, it just kind of resonated, I guess is the best way, with what he's saying. When he looked in my eyes, it was so intense that I felt the truth of what he was saying. So, and there was a spiritual recognition of him, but there wasn't I've seen him with my eyes in this lifetime. But, you know, again, when we're talking about spiritual dimensions and knowing things and nuances, and it's really hard to describe. So I felt the truth of what he was saying, even if I didn't have a conscious memory, there was something that I was resonating to. And I knew he believed absolutely that he had met me there. And so I thought, well, because he did not seem at all surprised to see me, and he was smiling at me as though he did know me. And so I had to accept that that was his experience. And here's the other thing, Simon, having had so many experiences of being out of my body and being capable of being in different dimensions and seeing other people, sometimes I don't know that I always remember where my spirit might go when I sleep or when I might be out of it. And certainly back then, I would have been a younger woman and at the time. And so, I've had so many unusual experiences over time, I guess that it didn't really surprise me so much as just made me think, well, why wouldn't I remember this consciously, even though I'm feeling a resonance here? So again, multiple levels of things in trying to process these types of experiences. And so I accepted the truth of what he was saying. And I thought about this for years. And it makes sense to me because, again, my whole focus from childhood on has been to be as a healing force. And having had the opportunities to experience other dimensions and being out of my body, it makes sense that I might show up and help people in another realm. It's not that unusual when I frame it up that way of understanding it better.
When you had a near-death experience, you were out of your body, and then you're having other out-of-body experiences. Are they pretty much identical, or was the out-of-body with the near-death experience a lot more intense, or perhaps your perception was much better?
Well, when I had my own near-death experience, it was incredibly intense. I mean, even at 4 years old, we're talking a long time ago. And I just remember that feeling of the floating at the edge of the pool, the love, the bliss. I mean, it leaves an indelible feeling. And yet over the years, the different out-of-body experiences are different. They, in terms of a near-death experience, because There's a physical compromise involved in a near-death experience where my body could physically die and my spirit is going to go somewhere. It's hovering near the body at that point because I was in the near-death experience early stages. But I think there's an enormous difference between having an out-of-body experience versus a near-death experience. Obviously, when you have a near-death experience, by default, you are out of your body. But a near-death experience is generally linked to the near-death experience, whereas an out-of-body, you do not need to be in a traumatic situation or near-death to have one. So the sights and the way sometimes, like I said, I may not remember things. Like I don't really remember standing there seeing my grandfather and my cousin at lunch, but they sure do. They remember seeing my physical self out of the body or my spirit self because my physical self was in bed. And then people saying they've perceived me in other times. I had a friend in California who said she perceived me standing there visiting her one night just for a flash. So, you know, and then having these, you know, dreams or wanderings or just having a deep sleep and being out of my body and not remembering. So again, there's just so many ways to have these experiences that it's very hard to confine them to things that you can easily explain.
So can we get on to what happened with David? Could you tell us how did you meet him, first of all? How did you find out that he was in hospital?
Well, I had, as I'd mentioned, I had grown up with alcoholism in my family. And so I was going through a pretty tough period where I felt I was drinking too much wine and I'd gone to some 12-step meetings. And then I'd stopped going because I was in my PhD program. I had two sons with disabilities. I was a single parent. And I was busy with school. I was teaching a class at our local university on marriage and family relationships. And that was, I said, well, you know, I made every mistake. I can certainly tell students what not to do. So I really enjoyed that class. But I had friends in the 12-step group who had told me about this wonderful man who had come in from the West Coast and had gotten terribly, terribly ill. And now was in a hospital and dying with multi-system organ failure and inexplicable at that time illness. And by the time that it had been diagnosed, like 2 weeks into it, he was not responding to the treatment protocol. But again, I didn't know him. And I had trained in Reiki, two types of Reiki at that point over many years because of my sons and trying to help them manage their health issues better. And so a friend of mine had told me to, you know, that David is his name. His mother was coming to town and also that she was going to be there at this meeting to pick up a 20-year coin celebration and asked me to come. So I decided to go that night. And that's where I met David's mother. Again, mother's here. And there was something about her that really touched my heart. She had flown in. She had been gotten the call from the hospital. She was in San Francisco. We were here in Richmond, Virginia. And they had called her that morning to come say goodbye because David wasn't going to make it. He'd been in the unresponsive coma now for going on 4 weeks, completely dependent on a ventilator. He had not regained consciousness. His kidneys had been destroyed by this very rare form of vasculitis at that time, called Wegener's granulomatosis, which leaves nodules on organs and scar tissue. Kidneys don't regenerate when they have that level of scarring. So he was, David was having to get dialysis to stay alive. The ventilator, at that time, they did not do the trach, so he'd been on basic long-term ventilator support. And his lungs and kidneys had completely shut down. He had sepsis. He had double pneumonia. One lung had collapsed, so he had a chest tube. He had sepsis. He had blood clots, and his heart now was out of rhythm and the paralytic coma. And now they suspected that brain injury because of he also had encephalitis. encephalopathy, which brain injury would be probably the outcome. So there were just, it was just a devastating illness, and he had not responded to the treatment protocol and in fact had gotten worse. So when they called her today, that day to come, and she did, this was September 22nd of 2005. So we're looking at nearly 20 years ago this fall. I had met her that night, and she said she had just come from the hospital and she had signed the funeral directives. And what touched me too was not only her, but people I had known from having attended this meeting in the past were standing around crying. And I thought, oh, this is just such a sad situation. And I did not feel that there was anything I could necessarily do, but his mother just touched my heart. And so at the end of the meeting, what I was going to say was how sorry I was. But what happened was, and this is one of those moments where what comes out of your mouth does not match what your mind is saying. Instead, what I said to her was, I don't think you should give up hope yet. And to this day, again, my mind immediately kicked into, my gosh, why am I saying this to this lady? I mean, she just said she signed the funeral directives and her son's probably not going to make it throughout the night. So, but anyway, and I told her, I said, I do Reiki. I would be happy. And I was on a prayer team at the church I was attending at that time. And I told her I'd be happy to go be with him and hold his hand, pray. I would be happy to do some Reiki. Of course, I could promise nothing if she would like, and I would need her permission to go in. And she explained to me that he was Jewish. And I said, well, that's fine. Reiki is completely respectful of anyone's faith or even if they have no faith and anything in particular, it's fine. It's just working with the body's energy field. And, all I could think was that as a mother myself, I would, probably want someone there maybe to help my son too, even if it might not do anything, just the intention of caring. And also I will say too, the community of the 12-step group had just been so rallying and so supportive. And so that was really important for me to see how caring people were as well. But anyway, she said it would be okay to go with the understanding that he might not be there the next day. So I was teaching the class the next day, and I was a graduate teaching assistant also while I was doing my PhD studies. And as I said, I was a single parent. I barely had enough gas in my car to afford to even go over to the hospital for this complete stranger for whom I really didn't know why I'd even offered to go. But I did offer, and I called the hospital after the class, and he was still there. So I thought that had been my prayer. I was like, gosh, I don't know why I'm doing this or what I'm supposed to do or why I even said what I did, but I have to trust there's a spiritual nudge here and I have to listen. And so I went to the hospital and went back to work with him. And before I did, I really firmly believe, with healing of any sort, it's truly up to the person. I'm just a facilitator, and this is their journey, their choice, their life, and their decision to make. And so I was not going to do anything if he didn't want any kind of healing. If he was just ready to go, that was his decision. What I did do was I remembered that my mother told me that when people are in a coma, they can hear what you say. And so to speak with him as though he were awake. So that's what I did. I introduced myself because he didn't know me and I didn't know him. And again, I couldn't even see really what he looked like because he had the ventilator in his throat. He had a feeding tube because of the long-term coma. He had all these bags and needles and lines all over. And he was terribly bloated because of the complete kidney failure. So it was just really awful. And I could see he was very sick. And the only thing keeping him alive was the machines. And they were just making the sounds that they make. And that was it in the room, the machines. And there he was. And so I introduced myself and I asked his permission to work with him if he would like me to do Reiki with him. And I told him the reason I was there was that I met his mother the night before and that he had obviously many friends who cared very much about him. And she, of course, loved him very much, and that's why I was here. And if he would want me or allow me to work with him, I would be happy to do so, but I'd need his permission. And I could hear him with my mind if he would let me know. And so I just stood there quietly and felt a push of air. And it wasn't from any of the machines, it was just a little puff of air in the room. And so I took that as permission. And when I took his hand, Simon, I was careful not to dislodge anything, and I said a prayer to start, and I could feel a lot of things about his feelings in his life, and I just felt that tug of compassion and sorrow, even though I didn't know him at all. It's just my spirit was responding to something. So I did the Reiki treatment, and it maybe 15, 20 minutes. He wasn't really responding. The energy I was feeling from him was very flat, and I could sense that he wasn't really in his body. He was hovering, kind of like the way I was hovering at the edge of the pool when I had had my near-death experience, because he was barely hanging on at that point. And when I was getting ready to leave, I told him a few things. I said, you do have a choice here to make, but please, please, please know that no matter what has happened in your life, there's nothing but love for you on the other side. And there's nothing you could ever do that you would not be loved. And I could feel some, sadness and shame and feelings from him and grief. And I was like, oh gosh. And so I told him, I said, if you decide that you want to stick around, I'm going to make a commitment that I will come back and I will help you through this, if you decide that's what you want to do. And if you don't, that's okay too. This is your journey. But I promise you this, if you decide that you're going to be here tomorrow, I will come back. And so I ended our session with a prayer, and I was getting ready to leave, and I was holding his hand. And of course, he had no grip. And as I was getting ready to take my hand away, I felt like it was fused to his. And I felt that back, and I was like, oh my gosh. And I kind of laughed out loud a little bit because I was like, he's reaching back. I was like, oh, he's there. And so I told him, I said, okay, if you're reaching back, so if you are here tomorrow, I promise you I will be back. So that's what happened. He was there the next day, and I came back. Do you want me to pause there for a moment?
Well, it's a thing, isn't it, that you went back day after day, and as you did, it seemed like the Reiki energy escalated. Is that right?
It did. Absolutely. As I continued to come back and he continued to stay alive, with some minimal improvement, for example, his kidneys began to have a little bit of function, which isn't unusual even when they've been destroyed with scar tissue. They can have a little bit of return to function, although they never fully recover because of the damage. So he was showing a little bit of improvement. But when I worked with him, I noticed the energy did increase. It was my hands would get just incredibly hot, which can happen in Reiki anyway. But the energy with him began to swirl around us both. And that was had never happened to me before. I felt that there was a just an amazing divine energy that was weaving through us both, almost like I called like the infinity sign of energy just going from me to him and back and forth. And it was so hard to try to come up with words again for it because we're describing these incredible experiences. But then something happened, and that's where the best term, that's where I end up coming up with the term shared near-death experience years later, because I don't know any other way to describe what had happened. After I worked with him for several days, he still had not regained consciousness, but he was, still there. I went into his room and held his hand, did my opening prayer, and that's when my consciousness shifted, where I was no longer in my body at his bedside holding his hand, but I was in that place of love, the other side, similar to where I'd been when I'd had my near-death experience at four, but different. This place was just so full of light. I call it like millions of dots of light trillions. I mean, you can't even quantify it. And I call it liquid love, even though it wasn't wet. There's no textures that quite fit, but it was just the most incredible love, peace, contentment, knowing, just know things. And there he was. And I was there with him. And there was his spirit hovering out of his body. And he had a decision to make whether he was going to go or stay. And I knew that. I mean, and as I said, years later, when I've had a chance to process it more and understanding with my near-death experience, how you can hover out of your body before you go, and him being in a coma, which is a little different than a catastrophic near-death experience that people talk about being in a tunnel. He had not had the catastrophic sudden event that would perhaps propel him to a tunnel. So he was in the hovering near-death experience, similar to what I had had. So there our spirits were, and that's when Simon, everything, I just knew him. Even though he was a stranger to me in this life, I knew him, and my heart opened. I loved him. I was in this forever time with this man or the spirit energy of someone that I had loved in a spiritual way forever. And my spirit knew that. And it was just the most incredible, I call it the every kind of love, because it's not like you can put it in a romantic box, friendship box. It's just beyond any kind of love. It's just everything. It's that kind of love. It's so huge. And yet I knew him there, and that's where I met him, because there he is and there I am. And we knew each other and we were just overjoyed to be together. And then it's timeless in that realm of consciousness. So I can't say how long in earth time I was there, but it couldn't have been very long. I'd say probably less than a minute. Could have been a few seconds. It's just hard to know, but the experience is so huge. And then I'm back in my body, standing at his bedside. He's still unconscious, and I am just stunned with this experience, because now I'm seeing that I do know this person's spirit. I love this person, but he's a complete stranger to me, and he's dying. And I cannot even reconcile what has happened, because I just had never had anything quite like that happen. And I don't know what to make of these feelings or any of it. It's just so shocking. And so I did what I knew to do, which is to just continue with the Reiki treatment and go home. And I was so knocked out by that experience. And, just not knowing what to make of it. So that's how I met him the first time. Was in that out of body experience, in that shared near death, where he's dying and deciding what he's going to do next. Let me pause for a moment there.
When you were in that near death experience space with him, did you communicate with him, or is it that you were just there together?
No, we were communicating, but you don't talk in words. It's just knowing. It's an exchange. It's just a download of knowledge. I knew him. I knew everything about him. He later said he knew everything about me. He knew everything. And we were just, again, we were sharing together that we loved each other. And I knew this. And it was just such joy to be there with him in this time. And now, and everything made sense, why I had gone and why I had felt the spiritual tug, and why maybe it didn't make sense in reality because I didn't know him in this life, but my spirit knew him and had always known him. That's exactly what it was. And we were having all this exchange of knowledge of our life stories, and in an instant, it's the instantaneous knowledge of things. And again, no matter what happened, I knew he was my forever love and there, and how it was going to work out on this reality and human, I had no idea when I got back what was going to happen next, because that's the nature of this type of love, was that I wanted him to do what was absolutely best for his spiritual journey. And if that meant that his body was so compromised that he could not come back to it and did not want to come back to it, or his journey here was done, that's what love would want too. There was not a selfishness at all about this. It was like wanting what was absolutely best for him. even if that did not include me, which at the time, you know, I would have, you know, I would have liked to have had a relationship in my life, but being a single parent and a student and a teacher, I did not have time for anything really. So I had given up at that point. And so I wasn't, and I was only there really for his mother. And I just, you know, none of this was on my radar that this, something like this would happen. So, but that's what happened. And it was just, again, the type of communication that is just spiritual. That's just a language all of its own.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's called We Met on the Other Side, and people can get that on Amazon and other places. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I want people to know that David was right. We did end up getting married, and we've been together now for, it'll be 20 years this fall since that experience happened. We've been married 19 years in another week or so. And he has way outlived the prognosis of 8 years. His health is fine. His kidneys are great. And we are so grateful to be together on this journey. And so something huge happened in that meeting. And, you know, how we met and continue to have this love story. And it's just been amazing. But yes, but that's why I wrote the book. I wanted people to know that love will find them. That's such an important message. It's not just me having an unusual experience, but that I want people to know love will find them and love will find a way. And when you're destined to meet people who are going to love you in your life, trust your heart, follow that nudge, and just see what happens. But keep that faith that something beautiful is orchestrating your life. And that would be the message I want to leave with people. But yes, as far as the book, that's why I wrote it, to share what truly happened, give some resources and prayers for folks, and to share the ups and downs of a pretty normal life that I was living until this experience happened with David. Well, I say my normal, qualified from my near-death experience, but just so that people can understand that there's just so many paths to grace and love in this life, and you know, and they deserve to have that. So I'd like to share that and leave your listeners with that message.
Great. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
This week, I was talking to Scarlett Heinbuch about her book, We Met on the Other Side. A great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon, where you get access to the extended episodes. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And you can now sign up for a 7-day free trial. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And my book about verified near-death experiences is out on Amazon. You can get it on paperback, audiobook, or on Kindle. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.